animal companions. This is Joy, your radio reading service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today, I'll be reading another chapter from Bob Tart's Kitty Cornered, How Franny and Five Other Incorrigible Cats Seized Control of Our House and Made It Their Home. And if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with Bob Tart's Kitty Cornered. Previously, we learned that Franny had stayed on the porch until the vet had cleared her medically. Though once cleared, she still wasn't interested in living inside, and she didn't seem the least bit interested in being a mouser. So today we'll continue to find out just exactly what's going on with the cats in Chapter 8 on The War Between the Cats. Having made her point about independence and having also realized that a cardboard box makes a comfier bed than a patch of ice, Franny stayed indoors during the final weeks of winter. And what icky weeks they were. One early morning, after a particularly hearty snowfall, I was pulling the covers off of our birdcage when something crashed into the window. I zipped outdoors with a flashlight and discovered a screech owl huddled in our spruce tree. This had happened once before. Holes here and there in the snow suggested an explanation. Instead of skittering around in the open with bull's eyes on their backs, the local mice were safely making their rounds via tunnels in the snow. With rodents off the menu, the owl must decide that a pet parakeet or a dove would do. The mice didn't like the winter weather any better than the owl. As the snow piled up on the next several days, the mice piled inside our house. I realized that the situation was worse than usual when Linda told me that she'd heard squeaks coming from the plant stand in our dining room. They must be coming from inside the walls, I said. No, they're coming from the plant stand. I didn't hear a thing in Linda's excavation of her pencil plant. Christmas cactus, aloe vera, and Moses in the bulrushes failed to uncover hidden evidence of mouse civilization. The next day, she said, I'm definitely hearing baby mice. She pressed her nose against our boombox that sat in front of Moses. Phew, they've got a nest in there. I refused to believe it until I turned the boombox around and sniffed a small round opening that suddenly and supposedly enhanced bass response. One whiff of eau de Rodin convinced me to retire the boombox to the barn. That cost me $98, I said. Now I need to buy a new one. You need to get a live trap, too, she said. As spring sputtered in and the house mouse population continued to increase, Franny began lobbying for a dash into the woods, not only for the mud that she could track across our carpet, but also to get away from Agnes. Instead of helping us with the vermin invasion, our black cat was doing everything she could to keep Franny from settling in. Agnes had never shown the slightest interest in the front porch, but suddenly racing down the basement stairs to score a spoonful of tastes like meat was passé. Now, the greatest Epicurean delight resided in the bowl of kibbles in front of Franny's box. Agnes would wait until I let Franny inside to spend time actively avoiding us. That was Agnes's cue to saunter out to the porch and loudly crunch on Franny's food. She never chomped down more than two or three bites on any visit, boldly daring Franny to do anything about it. When she tired of this, she would sit on the back of the porch and then fling herself at Franny when the little kitty came out from behind the entertainment center. As a startled Franny raced back to the porch, Agnes found herself scooped up in my arms and plunked down on the dark side of the closed basement door. "Are you going to put up with that?" I asked Franny. For the moment, the answer was, "Yes." Agnes wasn't the only porch invader under our roof. We had decided to clear the pet closet of non-pet items like a heap of dirty laundry dating back to the reign of the first George Bush and a window fan that neither Linda nor I remembered buying. Moving these to the basement created space for Lucy's litter box, and finally we had an unobstructed path from the front door to the dining room. Starting fresh with a brand new utility tub, I cut a U-shaped opening into the corner this time instead of the front. The innovation was a success. Lucy walked in on the diagonal, and as she turned to assume her favorite toilet posture, the tub wall directly behind her was at an above-the-tail height. accidents decreased, but unfortunately, so did usage. She disliked the size, shape, diagonal entrance, and closeted location of the new box and switched over to Franny's litter box instead. This was the extent of Lucy's forays across the battle lines. She and Mubi were non-combatants in the developing war between Agnes and Franny. As long as Mubi could steal 99% of my office chair upstairs and flatten herself against my calf at nap time, she was satisfied to pretend that Franny didn't exist. The day the war escalated didn't start out so differently from any other day. "Oh, don't eat that," Linda cried as I shoveled the second forkful of French toast into my mouth. I paused mid-chew as she sprang up and scraped the contents of her plate into the trash can under the sink. "Doesn't that taste funny to you?" I thought it was just fine. I figured that the unusual flavor was due to the just-woke-up patina on my tongue. "What did you make it with?" "I used a loaf of the whole wheat bread from the basement." "Not the duck bread?" Sejana had bought us two garbage bags bulging with outdated hamburger buns, bagels, dinner rolls, and other bread scored from the convenience store seconds before they went to the dumpster. I had crammed as much of it as possible into our basement refrigerator. For the rest, it was a race between our barnyard critters and the onset of mold for possession. I hadn't realized that I was part of the competition, too. "Sorry about that," she said. "It didn't smell stale. I'll make you an egg." "I don't have time. I'm already running late." A metallic clinking from beneath the sink told me that I would be running even later. "Oh, no, no, another mouse." She fished out the live trap behind the trash can and handed it to me. "Can you stop somewhere and let him go? Wouldn't it be easier to just let him have some French toast?" "That reminds me," Linda said. "I've got to make sure that I didn't put that bread back with the other bread for the ducks." "Why not? I can't feed them stale bread. It wouldn't be good for them." I wondered how much spoiled food I ate over the course of a week without knowing it, while our ducks, geese, hens, rabbits, and parrots got the fresher stuff. I also wondered why our mouse population kept growing even though the weather was getting warmer and we had four cats in our house. I received a partial answer when we shook off the winter cobwebs and took an afternoon walk. There was a warm breeze under the cloudless sky. It was a dark day for Agnes, since it gave her the opportunity to be an outdoor cat again, and a big day for me because I had survived the French toast. Our black cat trotted along at our heels as we headed toward the river, but Franny seemed reluctant to follow too closely for fear of getting attacked. She accompanied us at a distance as far as the neighbor's driveway before plunking herself down and turning into a white and black lump on the ground. Our walk to the river didn't take very long because the river had come forward to meet us. Rapid snow melt and 2 days of heavy rain had turned the high ground at the riverbank into a chain of small islands, ponds filled with low spots in our woods, and I could hear them and the slam of tiny suitcases as grumbling mice abandoned their holes and headed for our basement. At the water's edge, we found a juice bottle, a chunk of plastic foam cooler, a grocery bag, a pressure-treated post, all washed up by the river. I dragged the post behind me, somewhat envisioning it doing something somewhere in one of our pens somehow. A muskrat monitoring and motoring through the cloudy water dove by and saw us. "He's probably looking for the secret passageway," I told Linda. "What secret passageway?" she asked. "The one that the mice take into our basement. He heard about the free food and the lazy cats." Right on cue, Agnes bounded ahead of us to strike a pose, sharpening her non-existent front claws on the trunk of a fallen tree. Franny shot past her, kicking up fallen leaves as she joined us on the path. They trotted along together, Agnes slightly ahead of Franny, planting false hopes in my mind that they might become friends after all. "Those two sure look alike," said Linda. "I'll bet you a horse that they're related." Sure enough, both cats had the same build and same heart-shaped faces. They're standoffish in the house, but friendly outdoors, and both of them are tomboys, and they follow us on walks like little dogs. Their mincing gaits were so identical that as Franny pulled up directly alongside Agnes, they reminded me of a pair of buskies harnessed to a sled. I dropped the waterlogged post before we returned to our neighbor's driveway. I imagined making a week-long project of dragging it back to our yard a few feet every day. I was about to remark to Linda how nicely the cats were behaving when Agnes darted, snarling, toward the upstart. But Franny wasn't the shy cat that she played indoors. She answered the attack with a whack to the face of her possible great-great-great maiden aunt. Triumphantly, Franny bolted ahead of Agnes and waited for us with shining eyes alongside the barn. Agnes fell behind. The two cats were wary as we straggled through the basement door. The great outdoors didn't seem quite big enough for both of them at once. And the outdoors were shrinking fast as our woods continued to flood. Deer and turkey sloshed to the hill behind our fence to eat mountains of scratch feed, while mice began flowing into our 100-year-old house through every cranny and chink. When they couldn't find an opening, we could hear them making their own night. Bedtime was their favorite time for a snack of peanut butter on an outdated bed crust. Linda had just put out her nightgown when the trap beneath the sink clinked shut with enough of a jolt that we could hear it in three rooms away with the closet door closed. "Remind me why we can't leave them in a trap overnight," I asked as she threw on her coat. "Because they die of thirst overnight, and that defeats the purpose of a live trap." Zipping up her boots, she asked rather forlornly, "What do you think the temperature is out there?" "It can't be any colder than 34. I plumped the pillow behind my head. "Boy, this bed feels warm." She grumbled all the way out to the car, and I thought I could still hear her muttering as she drove away. Chauffeuring a mouse to its new lot in life was a fairly recent innovation. It dated back to last fall when I had trapped a mouse with a telltale nick in his ear and walked him a quarter mile down the street to McDonald's 2 miles ahead, figuring this to be an insurmountable distance from our house. The next afternoon, we caught the same mouse again. I dozed off thinking about the balmy weather that would soon blow into the state, sweeping the scads of migratory birds for me to identify. Next month, Bill Home and I were headed to Nyanquing Point to search for the yellow-headed blackbird. Common as mice in some Midwestern states, they were as scarce as cat-chasing mice in Michigan, except for a small breeding colony at Saginaw Bay. I was itching to see one, just as flock of the boldly colored birds landed on my outstretched arms and began to lift me up off the grass. Linda slammed the front door, and I tumbled back to earth. "Where did you put the mouse?" I asked as she thudded back into the bed. "Up to the turnaround just before Cumberland." I tried floating back to the yellow-headed blackbirds when a metallic clink nudged me out of my reverie. I knew that Linda had heard it, too, because she had stopped thrashing around. "Oh, no," she moaned. "You didn't reset the trap." "I didn't mean to." "I'll dump him in the yard, and you can catch him again tomorrow." But she had already grabbed her keys and put on her coat. The next morning, we barely recognized our woods. The individual puddles and ponds had held a meeting during the night and passed a motion to join together in a swiftly moving current. The river was about 300 feet closer to our door than usual. The flooding itself wasn't unexpected. Each spring, the low part of our woods turned into an aquatic playground for mallards, wood ducks, and Canada geese. But every 5 years or so, melting snow and buckets of rain convinced the river to leap its banks. While the rushing water remained down the hill and behind the fence, the diminution in territory intensified the war between the cats. I wasn't listening to the shrimpy speakers on my headboard shelf, trying to learn four warbler songs that all sounded like, "Please, please, please, to meet ya." But all I could hear was snarling as Agnes ambushed Franny beneath the so-called coffee table. "Okay, you two, time to spread out." I shooed Agnes down the basement stairs and out the back door. After giving her 5 minutes to lose herself in the weeds, I propped the porch door open with a water jug and watched Franny scamper out. With our acreage reduced by flooding to a mere decimal point, their quick collusion was inevitable. Agnes' trademarked shriek blotted out the olive-sided flycatcher on my CD. I should have skipped ahead to the catbird. "What's Agnes doing now?" Linda asked, pointing at the window. She must be chasing a squirrel or something. She doesn't usually climb the pine tree. She doesn't have front claws. She directed my attention toward Franny, who was skulking around the base of the tree. That's why. She's not afraid of Franny, I said. She'd chase Franny up a tree. There must be another reason, but she doesn't seem to be stuck. Spotting my face in the window, Agnes mewed, and I answered her summons. Standing on my tippy toes, I could just barely touch the bottom of the pine bough under her feet. By cooing her name and acting elated over our chance meeting, I coaxed her down the branch, snagged her leg, and pulled her from her perch as she bleated miserably. As I plopped her down on the cement floor just inside the basement, she whirled around, hurled herself across the grass at Franny, and chased her around the tree. When they reappeared, Agnes was the one who was being chased. She tore into the basement and didn't slow down until she had rocketed up two flights of steps to take refuge in the upstairs bedrooms. That was very, very naughty, I told Franny, who pranced in front of the pine and rubbed up against everything in sight. There were definite pluses to having the river so close. A pair of hooded Merganser's ducks had taken up temporary residence. I enjoyed watching the male raise and lower his crest as I raised and lowered my spoon at breakfast. I also liked wading down my neighbor's driveway until the water tickled the tops of my boots and the current nearly knocked me over. There were negatives, too. The last time the river had flooded like this, it had brought a mink to our barn to kill three of our hens, so I wasn't taking any chances. I herded our ducks and hens into the room of the barn that we had mink-proofed by reinforcing with chicken wire. I left the lights burning all night, and I turned a portable radio to 24-hour talk to suggest a human presence, though one of low intelligence. If you owe money on your credit card, then you shouldn't have a credit card, the talk show host insisted. The first three nights I expended a year's worth of arm-waving and racing around to chase the hens and ducks into the mink-proofed room. After that, they filed in as if they had slept there all their lives. Their enthusiasm nearly convinced me to join them in the straw. Then Linda made a discovery that gave me a second and third thought about wandering between the house and the barn after dark. "You won't believe what I saw," she said, huffing and puffing after hurrying back from the afternoon wade through the high ground. "Down by Don's house, I thought it was a crow's nest up in the tree. Then I looked up at it with the binoculars, and I saw this giant paw. I thought maybe a hawk or an eagle had killed some animal and taken part of it up its nest. Then I saw what I thought were sticks were actually fur, and I was looking at a bear." I shook my head. It had to be a raccoon. Bears don't climb this far south. I've never seen a raccoon that big. Show me. I was certain that she had misinterpreted the size of some much smaller and completely mundane object like a squirrel's nest or a speck of dirt on her glasses. We shouldn't go back there with a bear. I need to see it, I insisted on marshaling the courage of a man who knew there was no bear. We slogged through the river proper. The flooding had receded enough that we were able to pick out our way to the west of our neighbor's house by keeping to the high spots. Linda led me up onto a finger of land, which we walked along as far as the second knuckle. At first, I thought that the lumpy mass in the tree was indeed a squirrel's nest. But when I raised my binoculars, I saw a huge paw. This was a disaster. The ducks and hens were safe in our porous yet solid barn, but our geese occupied a pen that a bear could tear open like a bag of pork rinds. Later that day, I ran into Sejana at the store up the street, and she assured me that black bears were mainly vegetarian and that he'd probably been gone by the morning. It's just some little honey bear that the river displaced, and he's on the move. Still, I felt uneasy when I braved our bear-infested environs after dark to check on the ducks and hens. Knowing that the Ursus Americanus was prowling around below Ursa Major made the darkness seem especially threatening. I remembered that 2 weeks earlier, Linda had dreamed about glancing out the dining room window and seeing a bear in the backyard. She ran out to protect our geese as they cropped the grass in an unconcerned manner. When the bear started toward Linda, she woke up. I had poo-pooed her nightmare at the time, but now it proved that even when sound asleep, Linda knew more than I did. Speaking of bad dreams, Agnes must have thought she was having a recurring one. I was staring out the window at the usual speckle of three bluebirds on our hanging suet feeder when I noticed a familiar bouncing bough across the yard. A triumphant Fanny had treed Agnes again. This time I didn't need to extract her from the pine. She scrambled down on her own, and just before running into the basement, hesitated on the deck to haughtily lick her rump, indicating her low opinion of Franny. Inside the house, Agnes remained the undisputed alpha cat. She would conceal herself in the living room, revealing her hidey hole with a drawn-out growl whenever Franny ambled in. The noise was irritating enough to the people who were trying to enjoy some creaky old sitcom, but worse was when a heretofore undetected Agnes exploded from a concealment with a fuselage of snails and shrieks that scared the male human of the house far more than the female stray, causing him to drop his bowl of ice cream. Still, I was optimistic. It's like when we introduce a new duck to the barn, I told Linda as I raced Mooby to clean the spumoni off the rug. The top duck will bully the new one for a while, then the new duck finds his place in the pecking order, and they all get along just fine. Linda gave me a you-must-be-dreaming look. Agnes doesn't want to get along. She wants Franny out of here. It won't stay that way forever. Franny will learn to fit in. I was right about things changing, but wrong about the nature of the change. While Agnes had previously assumed a natural authority, she seemed to be waging a defensive battle as she undertook her guerrilla campaign. Her attitude toward Mooby and Lucy softened. She couldn't enlist them as allies, but she did the next best thing by crossing them off of her enemies list. Thus, I was witnessing the unprecedented sight of Agnes drinking from the hallway water bowl, mere inches away from mortal foe Lucy, who faced was submerged in the food dish. When Lucy came up for air and glared at her, Agnes hissed, but the reaction was a perfunctory and meaningless one, as telling her to have a nice day. Agnes may have mellowed, but the invading mice had suddenly become more assertive. Linda's habit of rejecting them out of the car window rather than shaking them out of the trap at a good distance away had finally caught up with her. "Well, that was nice," she said. "I was on my way to the bank, and when I stopped at the traffic light at Bowes Road, a mouse was looking at me through the windshield." I tried to picture this but couldn't. All I could come up with was a man-sized mouse driving a pickup truck in the other lane. How could a mouse stare at you through the windshield? Where was he? He was sitting in that groove in the back of the hood by the windshield wipers. He sat there staring at me through the glass while I waited at the light. He was very accusing in the way he looked at me. And before the light turned green, there was a second mouse on the right side, and he was staring at me too. I suppose they were trying to tell me that the engine was just too hot. I struggled to decide which was stranger, the event that my wife had just described or her interpretation of the event. Franny glanced up at me with a glimmer of amusement. "I'm glad you're getting a new car," I said. "Maybe we can get rid of half of our mouse population when you sell your Escort." Then I caught Franny's eye again, especially since certain individuals aren't doing anything to pay their rent. Next week, we'll continue reading from Bob Tart's Kitty Cornered, how Franny and five other incorrigible cats seized control of our house and made it their home. And maybe we'll find out if these cats ever do decide to live comfortably with each other. Our next reading hopes to debunk some of the common myths about dogs. You can't teach an old dog new tricks, is the myth. Many dog owners believe that once their pup has reached a certain age, training becomes impossible. It's only logical. When we see a young pup and their eagerness to pick up on commands quickly, we tend to think older dogs won't be able to do that. Because of this, many people give up on training their senior dogs, assuming the effort won't pay off. But is this belief really true? Place your bets now. Myth debunked. Old dogs can learn new tricks. As it turns out, age is just a number. Dogs are capable of learning anything at any stage of life. While older dogs may take a little longer to pick up new habits, just like we humans, their brains remain adaptable. Training activities work best when it's fun and positive and rewarding. So grab some tasty treats and start small. Short, Frequent training sessions are the key to success. Myth: dogs have no sense of time. Ever leave the house and come back to a dog who acts like you've been gone for years? Many assume dogs don't understand time, thinking they react the same whether you've been gone for 5 minutes or 5 hours. Since they don't read clocks, it's easy to assume that they live entirely in the moment. But if that's the case, how do they seem to know exactly when it's time for dinner or their daily walk? Myth debunked. Dogs do know the difference. Science confirms that dogs have a sense of time. Studies have shown that dogs can distinguish between different time intervals, meaning they know the difference between an hour and several hours. But how? They associate events with specific routines. If you always walk them at a certain time, they'll start anticipating it. Some experts believe that dogs use scent to tell time, as human odors change throughout the day. So yes, your dog really does know if you're late for dinner. And those are some interesting myths that have been debunked. We'll continue in our next show about some more myths about dogs and whether or not they're actually for real. Well, we've come to the conclusion of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Be well, everyone. Be healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.